everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm pleased to say we have David Laskin on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Long Way Home, An American Journey from Ellis Island to the Great War. You may not know it, but many of the American soldiers who are fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq are not actually American citizens. This, again, is something that Americans generally don't know. But the United States has a long tradition of offering people the opportunity to gain citizenship through serving in the armed forces. I believe this began in World War I, which is the subject of David's book. He traces the histories and biographies of 12 immigrants from Europe to the United States circa 1900 and into the Great War, and shows, interestingly, how after leaving their ethnically segregated communities, they became, in the military, Americans, or at least more American, whatever that means, and gained their citizenship. They fought bravely for the United States, even though they had not been born here, which I think speaks very well of the opportunity that is offered people in the United States. I really enjoyed talking to David today, and I'm sure that you'll enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, David.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks.
You are in Seattle, Washington, is that correct?
I am right now.
I lived in Seattle for a while, and they said that it rained all the time, but it didn't rain all the time when I lived there.
No, it doesn't rain all the time, although it is raining now.
It is, I'm sorry. Yeah.
You know, as you probably remember, we have beautiful summers. This is our secret, which I'm now letting out to the world at large. The joke in Seattle is starting July 5th, the rain stops. It always rains on July 4th, which is pretty much true.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have two gorgeous months.
But no, right, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that very well when I lived there, actually. We can talk about that in a little while. I should tell our listeners that we have David Laskin on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, The Long Way Home, An American Journey from Ellis Island to the Great War. As I was telling David in the pre-interview, he wrote a book called The Children's Blizzard, which is much beloved in my family. It is one of my wife's favorite books. My wife loves disaster books, and this is right at the top of her list. I can tell you a funny story about it, but maybe I'll do that later. She quite literally couldn't put it down once, and it kind of got us in trouble. This time we're going to be talking about The Long Way Home, which, as people who listen to this show know, I read all these books, and this is an absolutely terrific book, and it tells a terrific story of the journey of a bunch of guys from Europe, circa 1900, to the United States via Ellis Island, and then into the maelstrom of the First World War, and how they weathered that transition, and what it meant for them to become Americans in that way. So I highly recommend that you go out and buy the book. It's really a page turner, and David's a brilliant writer and historian. But David, why don't we begin the interview by having you tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I grew up on Long Island. I'm a child of the 50s, kind of the Leave It to Beaver era, which we now commemorate, but seemed pretty ordinary to me at the time. And, you know, I think my interest in history really grew out of my interest in literature. And I was very, very lucky. I went to Harvard College as a young man and majored in history and literature. And didn't even really know that that was a possible major. It wasn't really a double major. It was kind of one major. And we sort of thought about it. I mean, the joke was Middlemarch by George Eliot is kind of the perfect history and lit book. And you can kind of get both at the same time. And it was kind of like, well, we read history as a novel and we read novels as if they're history. That was kind of the buzzword for history and literature. And I think it really kind of that outlook stuck with me and really informed my way that I look at the world, the way I write, the way I read. And I went on to get a graduate degree at Oxford University, so I have a pretty fancy-dancy education, and that was in English literature. So basically, I read poetry for 2 years, so I'm pretty well read, I have to say. And, I think I'm one of the few people who actually has used every single thing I ever learned in college and grad school. All of those art history courses, all of the geology courses, they all came in handy. And certainly for The Long Way Home, World War I, I think probably there's more great poetry that came out of that war in England. I wouldn't say so much in the U.S., but a little bit in the U.S., but it's certainly in England, great poetry that came out of that war. And I think great, you know, great literature, too. I think it was a war that really shaped the way modernism happened. So here we go again with the history and lit. I think it was the lit side that got me going on World War One. But obviously, as you pointed out, The Long Way Home is a work of history.
Mm-hmm. You, of course, wouldn't know this. I taught in history and literature for a long time at Harvard. So
wow. I know the program pretty well.
Excellent.
Actually, you know, they had done something when I got there and taught in it that I don't know if they taught it this way when you were there, but every seminar was taught by somebody from X language department, English or French or Russian in my case, and then somebody from something like the history department. And I don't know if I really liked that because it sort of separated things in an interesting sort of way. One of us was the empiricist and the other was mm-hmm. the artist, and I don't know if that really sent the right signal.
I'm probably way before your time, and we didn't do it that way. But
yeah, I kind of imagined that you didn't because, you know, if you read great 19th century history before history took the kind of hard scientific turn, mm-hmm. They thought a lot more about I guess I would just prosaically call it storytelling.
Yeah.
And they are, 19th century histories are often much more novel-esque and less heavily footnoted than modern histories. I mean, modern histories, that genre still exists. And obviously, you've written a wonderful contribution to it. And actually, I would even say that it is flourishing at this moment. I get a lot of books by writers who write in nonfiction, and they write historical books, and some of them are just absolutely terrific. And you know, they're the first ones that people read when they go to Barnes and Noble. So they're not going to read my monograph on 16th century Russia. So I congratulate you on that. I really do talk to a lot of people that are interested in writing and reading this kind of thing, and I applaud anyone who can make a living doing it. How did you? Let me ask this: how did you come to write this book?
Okay, well, this was, I would describe it as one of those light bulb moments. My previous book, as you mentioned, was The Children's Blizzard, and so that book was about a disaster storm, which is, you know, a killer blizzard that hit the Midwest in 1888. But it was also about immigrants, and that was something that I didn't anticipate. I knew I was fascinated by that storm. I've written about weather before, and that was kind of what lodged in my mind. But And I knew I was going to describe the storm through its impact on a bunch of people. So the challenge was finding those people. And so I cast my net. I put classified ads in every newspaper in Nebraska and South Dakota, the major states that were hit by the storm, got back fantastic answers from all sorts of people, and kind of went from there. And as I went, I discovered that most of the people who were living in that region at that time were immigrants. Many of them were from Scandinavia. There were a lot of Germans. There were also quite a number of Germans from Russia, most of whom were Mennonite. So those were the people that I wrote about, and kind of fell in love with them. I fell in love with the whole immigrant story and just the amazing struggles and hardship and bravery of these people setting out into the unknown, settling in an environment that was extremely harsh and very unlike ones that they had been used to. So that's The Children's Blizzard.
I was going to say, if I could just interrupt for a second, you know, we live among those people here in Iowa and in Kansas as well, where I grew up. I mean, if you go to the local cemetery, many of the grave markers are in Czech.
Of course. Right. I'm glad you mentioned the Czech, because I was just about to say I did have a file for The Children's Blizzard called Czech Stories, and somehow they didn't make it into the book. And wouldn't you know it, in Lincoln, Nebraska, this woman with a tall kind of fur hat comes into the stalks into the reading and raises her hand and says, "You didn't put any Czech stories in." And that's the second largest group in Nebraska. And you know, and I love Ted Kooser, and he writes about the Bohemian Alps and you know, all his Czech neighbors, and I thought, oh geez, that was a real oversight. So my apologies to any Czech Americans out there, and I have to say, no Czech stories in my current book either, although I do have a Slovak story, a major Slovak story. That may not be good enough, but anyway, I'm digressing a bit.
No, that's fine. I made you digress. Pardon me.
Yeah. Okay. And I like to digress. But so the genesis of the book, so immigrants kind of dancing around in my imagination, very important theme, inspiring stories. I myself am the grandson of Russian Jewish immigrants from the Pale of Settlement, so kind of grew up with that whole immigrant experience in the background. Okay, so that's one side. The other side is World War One. Now, I talked a little bit about how that is such a literary war. One of my all-time favorite books, The Great War in Modern Memory by Paul Fussell. If you haven't read it, go ahead.
I had a chance, sorry to interrupt again, but I had a chance yep. actually to interview Paul Fussell once.
Oh, wow.
He was quite old at the time, and it was in connection with the book that he wrote on World War II.
Uh-huh, right.
This was really quite a long time ago. I believe, has he passed now?
I don't think so. I don't know either.
I
sent him a galley for blurb, and I got a scrawled note back, and it was so scrawled that it took me some detective efforts to discover that it was actually his signature. So I think he's still alive. He did not give me a blurb.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's worth plugging his books if anybody who is listening hasn't read them. They are all fantastic, and they're very – The Great War in Modern Memory is really kind of an academic book, but he writes other books. He wrote a book called Class. I don't know if you've read it, David, but it is
– I haven't read that one.
It is a truly fantastic book about American culture and class in the American context, and the book is a scream. It's just very funny. And then he wrote this terrific book about World War II, kind of pitched against the Studs Terkel Good War tradition. Mm-hmm. I forget exactly what it's called. Do you remember? It's called –
easy to find.
Yeah, I don't remember either, but it's a really terrific work because Paul Fussell was in the Second World War.
Right. Great War in Modern Memory, fantastic book, and has always, you know, that kind of cemented my interest in World War One. And so I was sitting at a Thai restaurant with my wife in Seattle one spring night, and that was the light bulb, and I thought, immigrants, World War One. I could do both. I could combine them. I knew this was a period of unprecedented and unrivaled immigration in this country, so I knew, I didn't know how many immigrants were in the army in 1917 and 1918, but I knew there were a lot. And I knew that America's involvement in the Great War has been understudied and I think underwritten about, and I thought, wow, what a fantastic angle on it. So that was how it got going.
Mm-hmm. And then, so how did you assemble – now, I should tell people who haven't read the book that the story is structured around the tales of 12 individuals. How did you find them?
Yeah, good question. So I did have the Children's Blizzard as a template, and as I mentioned, I advertised in there. So I kind of went back through some of the same means. I put a notice in the Norwegian American Historical Association bulletin and saying, I'm writing this book about immigrants in the Great War, and if anybody has stories. And that's how I found Andrew Christofferson, my Norwegian-American. I put an ad in the Italian America, which is the publication of the Sons of Italy, and that's how I found Epifanio Affatato. Michael Valente, another Italian, I knew I wanted to have him in the book because he was the only Italian American to win the Medal of Honor in World War One, and I tracked down his family. That took some doing, but it was not all that hard. Tommaso Ottaviano, one of my other Italians, his great niece's husband was somebody I wrote an article about, and we got to be friends and got to chatting, and he told me, hey, my wife has this incredible World War One story in her own family. So I'm not going to tell you every single one, but mm-hmm. it kind of went from there. I mean, it was just, I kind of cast nets in many directions, did a lot of advertising, Jewish war veterans, mm-hmm. ran a notice by me, met many Polish magazines. Things, you know, with the internet, God bless the internet. I mean, things just have a way of kind of, you know, going out there, seeping out there, and great stuff came back. So I had way more stories than I could possibly have put in the book, and some were very fragmentary, some were very detailed and complete. And it was just a question of kind of cobbling them together into a narrative. And it really was pretty late in the day that I suddenly realized, Eureka, I've got 12, the Dirty Dozen. So it was, that was kind of a cool moment. And then when I realized that, it just, and I thought, okay, now I can stop. You know, I can stop looking for others. And then the real challenge became kind of putting all the stories together. But that's maybe a different area. But anyway, that's so you know, kind of this was definitely a challenge to come up with these. And there were many sleepless nights when I thought, oh, you know, I need another poll. I need another poll. But they all came through in the end, so it worked out really well. And I guess one other thing to point out is, again, by luck, the breakdown, the ethnic breakdown in my book very closely mirrors the demographics of the day. So Italians were the largest immigrant group at the turn of the last century. I have 4 Italians. Jews were the second largest. I have 3 Jews. Poles were the third largest. I have 2 Poles, and so on. So it was quite lucky that I ended up really mirroring the population, the immigrant population of that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take this opportunity then to set the scene. Maybe you could tell our listeners and me just a little bit about immigration to the United States from Europe at the end of the 19th century.
Yep. Well, between the 1880s and the 1920s, there were 23 million immigrants who came to this country. So this is one of the largest population shifts in human history. Most of them were from Southern and Eastern Europe. And, you know, obviously this is a nation of immigrants, but the previous large swells of immigration, well, first of all, obviously the British Isles got us going. And then, you know, Irish and Germans were the big mid-19th century groups. But so after the Civil War, it shifted, and we start getting large influxes of Italians, Poles, Jews, et cetera, you know, all of Eastern and Southern Europeans who are the ones I wrote about in my book. And that sparked, as you can imagine, a lot of unease. There was a sense of these people looked a little bit different, especially the ones from Southern Europe tended to be darker. Their cooking smelled different. They had, many of them were Catholic or Jewish, unlike the Protestant waves earlier. Of course, the Irish were also Catholic, and that was a problem for them. So this was, they were viewed with a lot of suspicion, especially once their numbers became so large. And one of the things that I write about in the book is the kind of the birth of, well, really, I guess I'd call it scientific racism, and, you know, the tangled up with the eugenics movement. So Madison Grant, who's a friend of Teddy Roosevelt and a prominent New York lawyer, wrote this book called The Passing of the Great Race, which was published in I think, 1915. And he is basically has this theory that all of these Southern and Eastern European immigrants are from a inferior stock. Of course, the best stock is the Nordic stock, the Aryans. And, you know, then he kind of goes down to, you know, the Mediterranean and then down from there, the Alpine, and, you know, the Jews, of course, are at the bottom of the barrel. And this book is a huge bestseller, and it basically, I mean, if it sounds a little bit like Hitler, well, yeah, it was. And Hitler actually loved this book. Mm-hmm. So this was a kind of, you know, science, well, I mean, dressed up as science, but basically a rant against immigrants. Mm-hmm. And they were ruining the country. But what I found so interesting about the book is that not only was he saying, you know, they're polluting our cities with their, you know, their bad morality, they're thieving, they're inferior, but they also won't make good soldiers. Mm-hmm. They're inferior stock. They're weak. They don't have the moral fiber to lead, to be courageous in battle, and so on and so forth. So it's coming out during the Great War. So there's this sense of, you know, alarm that we have ruined our ability to fight, to field an army of warriors, because we've had this influx of immigrants, these inferior immigrants. And of course, this got my blood boiling, and I'm sure many of your listeners will be, whatever groups they're from, will have their bloods boiling. And so to me, it was like, you know, hell no. And I set out to prove him wrong, mm-hmm. in part. I mean, that was not a my whole motivation for writing a book. But, you know, I mean, the major examples that I had to throw in Madison Grant's face were my Slovak Marine, Matý Kosák, and the fighting Jew, Sam Draben. These were two career military guys. They were born to fight. They were both heroes. In fact, Kosák won 2 Medals of Honor in the Great War, and they were from this inferior stock. And, you know, darn it, they acquitted themselves more than brilliantly, more than bravely. And, you know, they're maybe the most stellar examples. And the fighting Jew, we can talk about him later, great stories about him. But, you know, all of the immigrants that I wrote about were brave. They really, I mean, one reviewer has said that this is a book about becoming American the hard way, and I think that really captures it. They became Americans the hard way, but they fought just as bravely as anybody else, and just as miserably. I mean, I don't want to say it's not all flag waving and back slapping. I mean, there was, you know, they grumbled, they hated the war, their families wondered why they were going off to fight for a country that was not their own. I'm not whitewashing it. This was not fun. This was not just, you know, heroism in the trenches. This was misery and suffering, and 3 of the guys I wrote about were killed in action. But I think there was a sense that these immigrant hordes, who were feared and to some extent hated before the war, were much more accepted and assimilated into the mainstream as a result of their service and their courage.
Yeah, this is a topic that we've dealt with several times on the show in connection with women and African-Americans who fought in the First World War, and Africans who actually fought in the French forces during World War I. And all of these groups, these 3 groups, were relatively disappointed. They had gone into the conflict thinking that they were going to be given all the rights, privileges, and duties of citizens of France and the United States, respectively, and they were not, which, as I say, is a disappointment. I wanted to go back to one other thing you said, and that is about the American elite's understanding of these people circa about 1900 to, say, 1915. I know that in my own reading, I'm always surprised the degree to which something like eugenics was completely mainstream. That it was that people thought about it in the same way that we think about, I don't know, evolution. We just think evolution is true. We don't really, you know, we know people who think it isn't, but we think that they're kind of loony. And, and I think that, you know, Margaret Sanger and these people, she was entirely mainstream at the time. The other thing is I think a lot of people, here I'm sort of speculating, a lot of people that remembered the Civil War remembered resistance to the draft in the North in the Civil War, which wasn't entirely an immigrant phenomenon, but it tended to be associated with immigrants. And they were worried about the lack of patriotism. Also, I mean, if you put it in the broader world historical context, America was the first nation of immigrants. I suppose you could include, I don't know, does Australia count? I don't really know. I'm sure somebody can find an exception to that. But people had to kind of reorient the way in which they thought about nations. I mean, France was for Frenchmen, you know, despite the Basques, and Russia was for Russians, despite the Ukrainians. What was America for? It was for Americans, but what was an American? And they didn't really know. And, you know, if you take a nation like a nation, you have to put nation in quotes in the American context, because what exactly is it? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think about your grandfather or my grandfather who came over from Europe. I'm like, for all I know, my grandmother and my great-grandfather on my mother's side didn't speak English. He spoke German, I don't know what he thought about America.
Yeah.
I have no idea. So anyway, that was kind of a digression, but it's important to kind of, you know, put it in the you know, it does make your blood boil when you hear this stuff. But to these people, it was really, you know, it seemed sensible, oddly enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, you raise an interesting question, Marshall, about, you know, the Civil War compared to World War I in terms of resistance to the draft. I mean, there was a draft in the Civil War, and then there was the next time there was a draft was World War I, and that was when immigration was at its high point. And, you know, I did find evidence of some resistance. There's one of the guys I read about is an Irishman from Butte. And on draft registration day, there was widespread protest in Butte among mostly the Irish and the Finnish miners who did not want to register and did not want to serve. The Irish, of course, hated the English, and so were pro-German because they hated the English so much. But there was, you know, aside from that, there were fears that the Jews would not want to serve. And initially, they were also pro-German because they hated Russia so much. And Russia, for the first 3 years of the war, was fighting with France and England. But then, of course, came the Bolshevik Revolution. The Russians pulled out, and the Jews were thrilled that Russia now looked like it was going to become a democracy, and you know, the czarist regime which had supported or at least turned a blind eye to the pogroms in which the Jews suffered so much was overthrown. So the Jews, and Russia was out of the war, so the Jews now felt, you know, they could fight for America. So there really didn't, you know, a widespread resistance did not materialize except among conscientious objectors like the Mennonites and the Hutterites. And there is a section in the book about that, where these were German-speaking Anabaptist people who believed in adult baptism, and there was a long, long history of protest among their groups and oppression in Europe. And they came here mostly in the 1880s, seeking freedom, settled in the Midwest. The Hutterites added not only pacifism, but also collective living. They were kind of Christian communists, if you will.
Yeah.
And when they were drafted, their church elders decided it was okay for them to report for service, but not to serve. And the book describes what happened, the torture that they suffered at the hands of the U.S. military when they went off to Camp Lewis, Fort Lewis, which it is now in Washington State, and they were actually court-martialed and imprisoned in Alcatraz. So that was, the major resistance to fighting in the Great War came from groups like that, you know, what we would now call the peace churches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, the Mennonites are all around us here in Iowa City, and we visit mm-hmm. them sometimes. They're nice folks.
Yeah.
Yes, they were conscientious objectors, and there were a mm-hmm. lot of them in the Upper Midwest. In fact, if I recall correctly, there's a I don't know if it's a famous poem, but there's a poem that I know about by E.E. Cummins called "I Sing of Olaf Gladenbig." Do you know this poem?
No.
Well, anyway, it's a poem. It's "I Sing of Olaf Gladenbig, Whose Warmest Heart Recoiled at War, a Conscientious Objector." And then it goes on and on. And it's about one of these fellows. Yeah.
Yeah.
Olaf, I don't know what the heck Olaf was. I don't know what he was. Olaf is not a Mennonite name by any means.
No, not particularly.
Yeah, but I think it's a kind of a famous poem, but about one of these immigrants who basically refuses to go. And in the Cummins poem, he's described as a very brave person who is mm-hmm. persecuted by the American military. But it was by no means an obvious thing, I think, in World War I that people were going to respond to the draft, because Americans had not really cottoned to it by any means. Not just
you're
immigrants,
right,
but just Americans in general didn't like the idea of the draft. I mean, I was just reading, even in World War II, mm-hmm. which we think of as the good war, there was, in Congress, there was a lot of resistance to opening the draft. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So we shouldn't pin this on immigrants. It was all Americans. And Americans are still kind of uncomfortable with the draft. We don't have it today.
Yep.
You know, in Europe, everybody goes. It's just thought to be like, that's what you do. But over here, we don't do that. So why don't you begin by telling us about a few of these folks? I don't know where you want to start.
Sure. Well, let's see. I think maybe I'll start with Tommaso Ottaviano.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned him before. I found him through a friend here in Seattle. And this is just one of the stories I love. He was the oldest in his family. They came from a poor village in Italy called Cerlano, between Rome and Naples, a hill town. And, you know, most of these hill towns are, when we visit Italy, we think, oh, how beautiful. But very, very poor back then. He really was no paying jobs. I mean, they had small plots of land, but really very limited sources of income. His father died when he was a boy. He had four brothers and sisters. He was the oldest, so he sort of becomes the man of the family. And they emigrate to America. So he's the, you know, I think he's 12 when they emigrate, and he's the head of the family. Nice-looking kid, dark, handsome, thin, looks a little bit like Rudolph Valentino, a little more rugged than that, but still in that mold. And they end up in Providence, Rhode Island, and he goes to work for a blanket factory. That's where this is, you know, Providence then was, you know, heavily industrial.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's supporting his family and, you know, doing the immigrant thing, and his mother is kind of a tough, hardened woman, but, you know, really relies on Tommaso for income and support. Well, he is of draft age when the war breaks out. I mean, when the U.S. joins the war, I should say, in 1917, and he is drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, he had two choices first of all, he could have pressed for an exemption because he was the sole support of his widowed mother. Did not. Second of all, he had the choice, which was true for all Italian immigrants then, of serving in the Italian army. Italy was fighting with the Allies in World War One, unlike the Second World War. So, Italy joined the war in 1915, and Italian Americans who were not citizens of the U.S., many of them decided to go back to Italy and fight with Italy. Well, he decided no. He was going to fight with the U.S., and he was going to fight, despite the fact that his mother was hoping he wouldn't. He decided to do his duty for his adopted country. So part of what fascinates me about him is that the family had his letters and postcards written to his mother, and I, for some strange reason, I decided to learn Italian. This book, it was just kind of for frivolous reasons that I love Italy, I love Italian culture, I love the Italian people, and so on and so forth. So I thought, oh, wow, here's my chance to use my Italian after all these years of basically just using it to decipher menus and the labels on beautiful pictures. But I was a little worried because, as you probably know, Italy back then, and it's still true, basically the people speak dialect. Standard Tuscan Italian is the language that you hear on the radio and the language of government and literature, but every village has its own dialect, and I thought for sure these letters were going to be in dialect, these war letters written back to his mama in Providence, but they were not. They were written in standard Italian, which I'm still puzzled by. Why he chose standard Italian rather than the dialect, and I was able to read them. And so they gave me a fantastically detailed sense of what it was like for this kid to be in the army. And the thing that was just so heartbreaking for me and so moving is that initially the letters are talking about how many other Italian guys there are in his unit and how they're palling around together and he's eating okay. She shouldn't worry. Things are fine. There's a lot of mention of God. Thank God, or God willing, I'll be home soon. The war will end soon. And then comes the Battle of the Argonne, which is basically the final push to end the war. It starts on September 26th, 1918. And his unit is rotated in October. And I was at the National Archives, so I was able to reconstruct pretty much day by day what his unit, he was in the 78th Division, what his unit went through, and so exactly where he was and what was going on, and then compare it to the letters. And you just see him becoming more and more devastated by the atrocities and by the slog. And actually, I went to France and visited the wood where he was fatally wounded and kind of reconstructed exactly what happened on the last day of his life. And, he tries to maintain a kind of carefree, cheerful tone with his mother. But by the end, he's just overwhelmed by the war. So that was one of the great stories that it just came to me by chance. I had the letters, I had the unit histories, and I was really able to kind of put all this together. So that was one. So let me choose one other, and I think I'll choose Sam Draven, the Fighting Jew, as my other kind of story to highlight. As I mentioned, he was a career soldier, and you just couldn't make this stuff up. I mean, it's Sam Draven. It sounds like it was invented by some screenwriter hack. And when I wrote that, I thought, gee, I wonder if they ever made a movie about Sam Draven. And so I go online, and turns out there was kind of variety from 1940. Had John Ford to direct movies about the Fighting Jew, and it actually never came to pass. But it was somebody else got the idea. Anyway, Sam Draven was this short, stocky. A friend of his described him as kind of like a vaudeville character, short, stocky, Yiddish accented Jew who comes from the Ukraine. emigrates. His family, his uncle is a tailor, so they decide, okay, he's going to become a tailor. And that lasted about a week, and then he decides, no, it's too peaceful for him. And the U.S. is invading the Philippines. They're recruiting men right and left, trying to raise an army to go after the Philippines. And Sam says, you know, do they give you a uniform? He said, yeah, you get a free uniform, Sam. And free burial, too. Okay, I'm in. So signs in, and then the first battle, it's a long description of it in the book, they're all kind of told to go forward against the Filipino rebels, and there's, you know, this huge explosion, and his unit is decimated, and the smoke clears, and they're all either dead or taking cover, and Sam is still, you know, trotting forward into the enemy territory, somehow survives this, and they say, well, you know, Sam, what the hell are you doing? He said, well, you know, the sergeant says charge, but he doesn't say stop, so he just kept going, and he was just kind of that type. Seemed, you know, like he was just kind of headlong and crazy, but actually another comrade of his wrote that he was actually extremely careful and shrewd, and had a great instinct for strategy, and knew exactly what he was doing in the battlefield. Mm-hmm. Well, he was in and out of the army. He was a soldier of fortune in Mexico. He fought. He supplied arms to Pancho Villa. he was like a bandito. He saved, you know, Mexican revolutionaries from jails by, you know, raids and shootouts. And he was a master at the machine gun. And, you know, just an absolute character. And then when World War One, when we entered the war in 1917, he's in his 30s, so well past draft age, and is married, and actually he's just fathered a little daughter, but decides he can't sit this one out. Reenlists as a private, is quickly promoted to top kick sergeant, and trains, he's in El Paso, Texas, and trains a bunch of raw recruits, and they're in the Battle of Blancmont, which is not a well-known battle, but really one of the most horrific slogs in the war, and Sam wins the Distinguished Service Cross, and anyway, so on and so forth, and I guess the final chapter, so he becomes a hero yet again in the war, comes back, and this is the Red Scare era. You know, World War One did not end with mm-hmm. with a great embrace of immigrants and celebration of their contribution to the war effort. Far from it. You know, the immigration quotas were enacted in 1921 and 24, and immigrants were looked upon as, you know, potential Bolsheviks and lumped together with the Huns that they had fought in the war, and so on and so forth. And the Ku Klux Klan is resurging, and the Klan is going to take over the American Legion post that Sam belongs to in El Paso, Texas, and he launches this campaign against the Klan, and he gives this wonderful, rousing speech about how, you know, we didn't wear any masks in France except for gas masks, and nobody asked me if I was a Jew when I enlisted and fought in the trenches, and these people are trying to, you know, keep out foreigners and keep out Jews, and we need to fight them, and he won. His post voted unanimously to, you know, bar the Klan from taking it over. So really colorful, crazy guy. Those are two of the people who I think, you know, one a heartbreaking story of just a sweet Italian kid who just was went in there and was in the wrong place at the wrong time and was doing his duty. And, you know, I really felt that I was able to bring him to life through these letters and through interviews with the family. And the other, this kind of larger-than-life character, you know, out of Damon Runyon, who's actually a friend of Sam Draben's. I think Runyon was the one who dubbed him the Fighting Jew. So that gives you a little sense of the color of the book.
Yeah. Have you, this is an aside, and have you been to the, I think it's called the Jewish American Military Museum in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah.
I used to ride my bike by it every day, and I never went in, and I really regret that now.
Yeah, I was actually just speaking there last week.
Oh, were you really?
The first leg of my book tour.
Yeah.
It's an interesting place. I mean, yeah, they have a lot actually about women, Jewish women in war, and really cool displays about nurses and wax and waves and things. But yeah, it's an interesting place.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it because, you know, in so many towns, and especially on the East Coast, but that's not only true in the East Coast, it's also true in Colorado, that there's a Italian-American League or something.
Right.
You rarely ever see. I mean, when I first saw the Jewish American Military Museum, I was like, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The Italian-Americans are big on that kind of thing. But I was like, wow. And I never went in, and I really regret it. So if anybody from the Italian or the Jewish-American Military Museum is listening, I'm suggesting that everyone come visit you there. So I wanted to talk to you about ethnic relations in the Army. And this is at a time in which people called each other ethnics. This was kind of the colloquial term for people who basically weren't Anglo-Saxons or black, mm-hmm. I think.
Right, right.
Maybe you could describe a little bit the way in which ethnic communities were arrayed in the United States circa 1915.
Sure. I would say that the short answer is extremely isolated. Mm-hmm. And then I'll elaborate a little bit. There's a section about the Polish Americans in the book, and I found a study that was done, I think, in 1915. About the Polish communities, and they basically said they have no use for English, they have no contact with anybody outside their own communities, they go to Polish churches, they go to Polish stores, they read Polish newspapers, they work often in factories, steel mills or coal mines were kind of the biggest occupations in which they're speaking Polish with their fellow workers, and they might as well be in Poland. Very similar in a lot of the Italian communities. Not only were they isolated, but they often kind of reconstituted their Italian villages in Brooklyn or in Providence or in Buffalo or what have you. So there was, the Italian church had the same feast day that they had back in Calabria or Sicily, exactly the same day, the same statues, the same customs, the same food, the same dialect. So these were communities that were, obviously came here knowing nothing and, with very limited resources. And what do? You find relatives, you find neighbors, and you band together. You find your fellow countrymen and reconstitute the life that you had in the old country in order to survive. And that's pretty much how it was. So these communities were very tight-knit, and there were often, I was actually just speaking in Chicago at the Polish Museum of America, which is associated with the Polish Roman Catholic Union of America, which was kind of a life insurance company that got going to help out Polish immigrants, and they had a newspaper, the Narod Polski, and very tightly bound through these organizations, through either companies like of this sort, insurance companies, or through fraternal organizations or churches, synagogues, what have you. So that was pretty much their toehold when war broke out. Many of them did not speak English, and even down to the second generation, one of the guys in the book, actually Max Chominski, is Kashub, which is a kind of a offshoot of Polish stock. I mean, there's Slavs that are Catholics like Poles, and they lived in Pomerania, and they consider themselves distinct ethnically, but they're kind of lumped together with Poles. And this guy, Max Chominski, his parents were immigrants. He was born in Polonia, Wisconsin, but never learned any English because there was just no need for it. So, when the war broke out, and I keep saying broke out, when we entered the war, they were drafted, or some of them enlisted, and then the army was saddled with this huge social problem of what to do with these immigrants who did not speak English, who were so acculturated in other cultures, but certainly not in American culture. And to its credit, the army responded quickly and sensitively, and I was quite impressed by the measures that they took to acculturate these immigrant soldiers, to teach them English, to bring in officers, who are Italian or Polish or Jewish or Russian or what have you, to break them in. Now, obviously, there was a, they had a vested interest in turning these immigrants into functioning soldiers who could understand orders and, you know, be identified with the U.S. And, of course, there was a heavy dose of civics. When they were learning English, it was, you know, kind of entwined with the curriculum. But still, I think, you know, and the Army made sure that the Catholic, you know, Poles and Italians were able to confess in their own languages, so they really understood what was going on. And so, yeah, I think, I do think the Army deserves a lot of credit for reaching out to the immigrant communities. And, you know, I really think that it made a huge difference. I think they got out of their ghettos. I mean, one of the kind of small examples in the book is that I found a book called Joe's War by an Italian-American called Joe Rizzi. And he was referred to by his comrades as WAPI. And, of course, you know, that really pissed him off at the beginning of the war. Crap, here I go. You know, and he would always get into fights. Well, by the end of the war, it kind of became a term of endearment. I mean, oh, here's WAPI. You know, he's our buddy. So it kind of, the ethnic slur, which was distancing and insulting and humiliating, gets turned around by service together, by, you know, by being in the trenches and by the comradeship and that loyalty that develops out of that into kind of a term of endearment. And I think that's a small example of the kind of transformation that I think happened not only in the ethnic communities, but in the mainstream community too, when they saw how well these guys served and how they were just, you know, just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that I watch a lot of war movies and I read a good amount of, a good number of war novels as well. And there's these kind of stock characters that I think largely come from World War I or World War II. And, you know, that's the wisecracking Jewish guy.
Right.
And then there's the lumbering Norwegian guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's the mama's boy Italian guy. And, you know, these characters are really right out of World War I. I mean, they.
I know.
But, I mean, I think one thing that would shock us is in fact, the degree, the lack of what I think might be properly called a kind of speech code or political correctness, because the use of ethnic slurs at the time was ubiquitous. It was absolutely everywhere. It was a time before there was any sort of speech code like that impressed on people. Before we move on to talk about the Army as a kind of mechanism for assimilation, which I want to talk about a little bit more, I do want to pause for one moment and note the incredible historical short-sightedness of all of Americans even today regarding assimilation, because you hear these same things. You hear these things about communities that will not assimilate.
Right.
From Americans today, and, you know, there are big Hispanic communities or Korean communities in Koreatown and in Los Angeles or wherever they happen to be, Hmong communities, and that they say, well, look, they're not assimilating. But
right.
It never lasts more than a generation or two.
Absolutely.
Ever, anywhere.
Yeah.
And
no,
I mean,
I agree. And
compared to the degree of ethnic homogeneity among these communities, within these communities, circa 1900, I mean, it's nothing like it is today. I mean, really, it was. You went to the Lower East Side. That was the largest concentrated population of Yiddish-speaking people in the world.
Right.
Brooklyn was the third or fourth largest. You know, it was the third or fourth largest city in the United States.
Right.
And nobody spoke English. And as far as I know, they speak English there now. I don't know. It always amazes me that we think that somehow the children of these people that are not native speakers and do live in relatively segregated communities will not assimilate, because they will. I mean, that's what America does.
Yep,
we will assimilate you. We're like the Borg. We will assimilate you. So, yeah, I did want to talk a little bit about the Army. One of the things you discuss in the book is why men and women, I suppose now, fight as hard as they do. And one of the points you make with reference to Chris Hedges, I would make the same point with reference to Eric Maria Remarque, is that they fight for their friends and their units, that they don't fight for their nations or anything like that.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. You know, I think, right, I mean, Chris, I'm glad you brought up Chris Hedges and his quote about how, you know, people do not go into battle for God and country. They go in for, you know, their own asses or their buddy next to them is absolutely true. And, I think to me, this was the first time that I really immersed myself in not only that kind of, you know, the literature of the war, but the diaries and the memoirs and the, you know, the kind of the unit histories and the field orders, all the kind of the, you know, the sort of ephemeral papers that are produced by people who are actually in it. And what you, when you read that, you don't, I mean, what you get is this sense of dailiness and the sense of whether your feet are wet or dry, or whether how much you've had to eat, or, you know, whether your buddy is still alive, or whether you hate your captain or love your captain, or, you know, how many miles you have to march. And, you know, it's not really about ideology or strategy or, you know, enmity or patriotism. It's just about survival, your own survival and the survival of the people you're fighting with, and kind of getting through. And I think that's it. Now, I have not served in the military, so I can't speak to this from direct experience, but I certainly have read a lot and immersed myself in this literature. And I would say that's an incredibly powerful bonding phenomenon. So I think when you see what this daily life was like, and then, you know, I mean, it's a little hard to uncrust World War One from the cliches that have adhered to. Well, I think this is true for all history. I mean, I think, you know, you say World War One and everybody thinks, you know, trenches, mud, rats, mm-hmm. bombing, gas, slaughter, machine guns. And those are cliches, but they're absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And when you kind of really hunker down with Remarque in All Quiet on the Western Front, or with Tommaso Ottaviano in his letters to his mother, this is what they lived with every day. And the only way that they were able to survive and not go crazy was through this sort of comradeship and through this bonding with their buddies. Mm-hmm. And if they were lucky, I mean, some of them, you know, really ended up with great officers who were leaders who they really felt inspired by. But, you know, it's not about Wilson or the Kaiser or Pershing. It's really at that unit level. And, you know, so I think for me it was especially poignant that these guys entered the war barely speaking English, you know, not only having no real loyalty to the U.S., but many of them, for the Italians and the Jews in particular, had no loyalties to their countries of origin. They had no tradition of national loyalty. I mean, the Jews obviously had been persecuted in Europe, so they were loyal to their religion and their families. And pretty much the same was true for Italians. There was a, you know, Italy was only unified in the 1860s, and even to this day, Italians will be loyal to family, church, village, you know, there's this sort of campanile.
I was going to say, Italy's unified?
Yeah, right. So, you know, these are people who did not come in they came in with God, but without country. Yeah. And yet somehow they had this sense of belonging in the military. And, you know, the thing the word that comes up over and over again is pride. You know, their families, you know, one, two, three generations later, I mean, these are the people I interviewed to get these stories, were just so damn proud that their dad, grandpa, uncle, great uncle served a country that was not his own, served bravely. And, you know, I think it ended up really cementing the bonds of these immigrant groups with their country. I should mention that I did interview two of the guys in the book. They were still alive at the time of my research. Tony Piero was 110.
Wow.
And Sam Goldberg was 106. Two living Great War veterans who I was lucky enough to sit down with and chat with. So those were unforgettable experiences.
Well, yeah, one of the reasons I mentioned Remarque and All Quiet on the Western Front is that, to me, that is the ideal history and literature.
Oh, yeah.
To hearken again. Because, you know, there's nothing specifically German about that book.
Right.
You really could take every German reference out of it and substitute a French reference, or an English reference, or an American reference, or a Russian reference.
Right.
It really is about the experience of those soldiers in a place like that, and
right.
how they grow to love one another and grieve for one another when they are one by one killed.
Yep.
I remember very distinctly, I was just talking to my wife about this last night, how
I basically had never read a book before I was about 17, and how I found All Quiet on the Western Front at Night, and I read it to cover to cover, and I just thought how really cool, quite an amazing book. I before we close the interview, I do want to say something about the really significant relevance of a book like this today. I don't know why it is the case, but Americans tend to forget that we are involved in two hot wars right now, and many of the people serving are not American citizens.
That's correct.
Yeah, maybe we could talk a little bit about that. You know more about it than I do, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, today, you know, in World War One, 18% of the Army was foreign-born. Today, it's 5%. Now, different groups in World War One, obviously the groups I'm talking about, you know, Jews, Poles, and Italians, by and large today, it's that the largest immigrant groups are Filipinos and Mexicans. Different names, slightly different numbers, but very much the same issues. And so, you know, I have to say that it riles me a little bit when people talk about how, well, you know, the immigrants back then, you know, in the turn of the last century, you know, they did their duty,
right,
and they're not doing their duty now. Well, yes, they're doing their duty now. I mean, we have a volunteer army.
Yep.
But and I think a lot of the reasons that people enlist are economic. But, you know, the research that I've done into the immigrants in the Army now, exactly the same issues come up and exactly the same loyalties to their unit, loyalties to their adopted country, you know, bravery or, you know, their people, just as the Jews, Italians and so on were people in World War One. And so I think really, these things have not changed. Interestingly, another thing that hasn't changed is the amendments to the immigration law, which permit soldiers in active duty to become citizens instantly. That law was amended in May of 1918 to reflect the large numbers of immigrants in the Army back then. So they waived the 5-year residency requirement and the necessity to have two people vouch for your character. Immigrants on active duty were instantly citizens if they wanted to be, and the same is true today. So the government has recognized this service, and obviously many immigrants are taking advantage of it. So, yeah, I mean, to me, this is the great thing about studying history. You see the events of the past mirrored in the present, and I think a lot of prejudices and kind of preconceptions are easily overturned when you go back and see how similar things were in many ways back 100 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. Again, we have this kind of historical myopia that short-sightedness. You know, immigrants today, they're not like immigrants were. Well, you know that they are.
Yeah,
sorry about that. Yeah,
right.
Your great-grandfather was like that.
Right.
And that guy right there. I also think, you know, I mean, this will sound ridiculously patriotic and almost jingoistic, but I think it speaks remarkably well of the United States in general. The people would want to come here and fight for us. I mean, they're not, you know, they weren't born here. They don't, you know, they aren't among us. They aren't us, and they want to become with us. They want to join us, and they will fight to do so. And I just think it speaks remarkably well of our collective enterprise. Sorry to sound so patriotic.
No, I agree. I mean, and I've come out with the same kind of patriotic line, and I myself am a heart-bitten, middle-aged, cynical, you know, pointy-headed intellectual in some ways, but I do think that, you know, this country has been great to my immigrant family, and I think I do think that one of the remarkable things about this country is how readily it has welcomed and absorbed and assimilated, if you will, all of these immigrant groups.
Yeah,
and it's still going on today.
Really,
and so I think immigrants have made us great, but I think we are great to our immigrant populations by and large. Obviously, there's frictions and there's issues, but I do think that, you know, this is a country where people like my grandparents could be free and prosper for the first time. And that's certainly true for all the guys I read about in the book. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with waving the flag.
It really is remarkable. I mean, I think in the broader historical perspective, America is an incredibly successful experiment in assimilation and nation building. It is no case like it in world history. I'm sure that one of my listeners will write me and tell me that there is, but I can't think of one. And while we're on the subject of your grandfather or great grandfather, it is a story I'm sure I've told on the show before, but a friend of mine, he was moving. This is many years ago, not many years ago, but a number of years ago. He was moving to Lower Manhattan, and he happens to be of Jewish descent. And he told his, I think he told his grandfather that he was moving to Lower Manhattan. And his grandfather said, "I spent my entire life trying to get out of that place, and you're moving back."
I know. It's like the name Max. You know, everybody, you know, back in those days was named Max. And they were like, "Oh, geez, why would you ever call anybody Max now?" Like every other kid you see in a playground is named Max. So I don't know. Things come back.
Yeah, it's funny. So anyway, we've taken up really a lot of your time, and I appreciate it. It's been fascinating talking about the book, and I want to thank you for writing it. Let me ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, yeah, I'm working on a book that actually has in many ways grown out of this book, The Long Way Home. And what I'm working on now is a family history about the three branches of my mother's family. And I'll just talk about it briefly. My one branch came to this country as immigrants, as you know, talked about. And one of my great uncles served in the Great War. He was in the Big Red One, 1st Division, and he and his brothers founded a business that was quite successful, and their sister founded the Maiden Form Bra Company.
Really?
So, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, interesting group. This was, these are all my grandfather and his siblings founded these two very successful companies. Well, cousins of theirs left the old country and went to Israel as pioneers in the 1920s and started a kibbutz and were there at the founding of that country and went through its history of, you know, the British Mandate and then the independence and so on and so forth. Uh-huh. And cousins of theirs remained in the old country, which was then became Belarus, and were killed in the Holocaust. Uh-huh. So one family, kind of one group of cousins, ended up really living through and being part of the three great movements of 20th century Jewish history, the immigration to the U.S., the founding of Israel, and the Holocaust. And it was, again, a little bit of a light bulb moment. I didn't know about the Holocaust side of the family, but I've learned about that since. So, again, I'm putting these three branches together and just describing what happened to them and how they got swept up into this. These cataclysms and to some extent successes. So that's what I'm working on now.
Yeah, that's I'm reminded of another story that I'm sure I've told on the show. A professor of mine who taught Russian literature. We read Tolstoy, I think, and he handed out some evaluations after the class and asked us what we thought about it. And one of my more clever colleagues said he liked the class, but with material like that, you really can't lose. And I kind of feel the same way about those three stories. That is just absolutely fantastic material for a book, and I'm sure that in your extraordinarily able hands that you will come up with something that that everyone will want to read. And I hope that you come back on the show when you get it
done. I would love to.
That's terrific.
Thank you. Thank
well,
thank you,
David, we've been talking to David Laskin about The Long Way Home, An American Journey from Ellis Island to the Great War. David, I want to thank you again for being on the show.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with David Laskin about his new book, The Long Way Home, An American Journey from Ellis Island to the Great War. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope that you have a great week.